Shrink Wrap Radio number 571, The Dream Life of Families, with Edward Bruce Bynum, Ph.D.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is clinical psychologist Edward Bruce Bynum, Ph.D. He's the author of the recently updated book, The Dream Life of Families, The Psycho-Spiritual Connection, which will be the focus of our interview. For more information about Edward Bruce Bynum, Ph.D., please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Edward Bruce Bynum, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Good. Well, I'm so happy to have discovered your book, The Dream Life of Families. And as I was reading through it, I saw so many names that I personally recognize. And it looks like you and I have been traveling in the same circles, but never met. So it's really nice to make your acquaintance now.
Well, same here. I'm sure we've been at similar Association for the Study of Dreams conferences, yep. And many of the folks who we admire we've sat in the same room with at the same time. So it's just one of those little final synchronicities. We're able to talk directly online with each other, and hopefully broadcast out to lots of other folks.
Yeah, exactly. And something that you may not know about me is that for many years, I was a professor at Sonoma State University, and I taught a course called Myth, Dream, and Symbol, in which I did dream work with undergraduate students.
And great.
Yeah, and it was a great experience. People did really deep work much of the time.
Oh, yes. Well, as you well know, work with our dreams has been on the forefront of the expansion of human consciousness since our earliest days on the savannas, you know?
Yeah.
And it continues, and today, and undoubtedly, in some form or another, as we ride in metal ships between the stars, we'll still be contemplating and studying our dreams.
Oh, I like your vision there. Now, I did mention your book, and I notice when I look at the, at the publisher's page, or that first page or so, that actually the original version was written some years back, but that you've updated it just this year. Tell us a little bit about that process.
Yes, when it first came out, it was back in 1993, I believe it was, and it was I felt the need to do my homework, do the research, and keep my arguments lean and tight.
Uh-huh.
And then nearly 20 years, I've loosened up quite a bit to include not only what I originally put in there, but also some of my other experiences, and also to talk and feel freer to talk about the implication of dreaming and the wider spiritual and evolutionary process that, seems to be afoot right now. And so part of that is just the expanding consciousness and freedom of that, and the other, quite frankly, is I'm approaching 70 years old, and so
okay.
So
what are they going to do to you now, huh?
What are they going to do to me now? So put it all out there.
Right, why not?
Why not? It's what I feel, it's what my deepest intuition is, and I don't want to leave this earth without having said it all.
Yeah, hey, good
my
for
satisfaction.
You. That's yep. a good role model there. Well, let's step back just a little bit into your personal history. What drew you to becoming a psychologist in the first place?
Well, believe it or not, my earliest days that I can remember out in Southern California, I was always interested in dreams and in nature, and I don't know, they just seemed to go back and forth with me. We'd have we'd collect butterflies and insects, and I would wonder, were they, like the birds, were they conscious just like me, and all kinds of things like that, you know. And so I got interested in dreams. And also, I grew up, I was very fortunate, I grew up in a culture, African-American culture, in which dreams are really, really, really admired, studied, and the truthfulness of dreams is not held in doubt. And that includes not only the matter-of-factness, the day-to-day reality the dreams reflect, you know, the whole day residue and all that kind of thing, but also the spiritual dimension of dreams was an open channel in the culture I grew up in. And
well, that's particularly interesting to me because I grew up in Los Angeles, when you say Southern California. Yeah, so I know we've got a lot in common. Also, the only father that I ever really knew in the early part of my life was actually my stepfather, who was African American, and so I had, there's a whole half of my family that I grew up with, you know, with his relatives. So then they were, you know, de facto my relatives. I have to say, though, I did not encounter that interest in dreams. I didn't have it myself at that point in life. And so that's kind of a new area. I'd be interested to hear more about what you have to say about that.
I grew up hearing about people having dreams about their ancestors showing up in their dreams and people dreaming about people who were no longer there and people dreaming about people who just died. And so it was a fertile area. It's not that people had necessarily quote answers unquote, but it was like, this happens.
Yeah.
This is the way it is. This is the way it is. And that reality stayed with me all through my, growing up. And, eventually, you know, I made my way to, the East Coast, because my father was in the Air Force, and so we traveled, every 6-8 years, and I ended up in New Hampshire, and I went to college at the University of New Hampshire, and as an undergraduate...
I have to cut in again. I taught for 2 years at the University of New Hampshire. I switched jobs with a professor at UNH, And he took my job for 2 years at Sonoma State, and I lived in Durham, outside of Durham. And
so did I.
In Barrington, where he had a beautiful cottage on a lake.
I went to UNH, and so we have literally been tracking each other.
I know.
Doppelgangers for 50 years.
This blows my mind. We're gonna have to get together at some point. Now, so you were studying psychology at UNH.
Yeah, I was studying psychology at UNH. Psychology at UNH, and as an undergraduate, and that was very risky because, you know, what happens if I don't get into graduate school? It's a big gamble. But I did it anyway, and because the study of dreams was very interesting to me. It just drew me. Plus, I was at that time, I was a budding poet. And so there's an intimate relationship between dreaming and the arts, particularly the visual arts and poetry.
Sure.
Actually, the new edition of Dreamtime that's coming out from ASD has a long poem in there about dreaming that I got in there.
Wonderful.
So I've continued my interest in dreams and in the arts and psychology. And I was fortunate enough to get into a good graduate school, Penn State. And there I began a formal study.
My undergraduate work was at the University of Pennsylvania.
I was at Penn State and State College. And got my doctorate in clinical psychology there. And I got it in hypnosis.
You know, that was another major interest of mine.
Yeah,
much to talk about. My doctoral dissertation was on hypnosis.
So was mine. was on hypnotic age regression.
Oh, good.
Hypnotic age regression. Good. Yeah. And actually, my original proposal for dissertation, what I initially wanted to do, they wouldn't have it. They said no. I wanted to do a study on dreams and ESP.
Yeah, Yep, I can understand that that might have run into
it. They did not want to hear about it because I was enthralled with Stanley Krippner's work. He's one of my great heroes and great mentors.
Yeah, mine too.
And I had read his book Dream Telepathy, and that got really close inside of me because I'd had dreams like that myself.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, no way. Although, interestingly enough, they said I could use their lab at night.
Yeah. So I've interviewed Stanley. Yeah, I've interviewed Stanley two or three times here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just by the way. And and that book had an. I discovered that book just towards the end of my doctoral studies. And it was very exciting to me. What year did you get your PhD?
I got my doctorate, won that guy in 76, I believe, finally, 76. I got to Penn State in 70, and I was there for 4 years, and then I left and did some internships, and the degree was not finally awarded until 76.
Okay. I'm a little older than you, actually, and so I got mine in 70, and I was kind of breaking ground, too, because mine was about the role of attention in hypnosis and meditation. And, you know, that wasn't an easy one to run by the committee. Nobody knew what I was talking about.
I had the same situation, but unfortunately, I had some folks that did know about hypnosis and in general, and so I was able to sort of go that path. But I maintained the interest in dreams, and... Then I did my internship, and then I did a postdoc. I did a postdoc at the place called Elmcrest Psychiatric Institute, and they did was on family therapy.
I was going to ask you because therapy. I noticed that your book you've got a foreword by Carl Whitaker. Is that the Carl Whitaker of family therapy fame?
Yeah, we became friends. He would come through periodically, and he and I just struck up a conversation. And he was kind of like far out, and I was pretty open with him and vice versa. So we began correspondences, and I had a correspondence with Stan Krippner, and it just went back and forth. So I got the nerve up doing a lot of family therapy, including multifamily therapy, to, ask some of my patients one day, would you humor me? Would you take down, and don't share with each other yet, because I might want to use it in therapy, but I want you to write down your dreams.
Uh-huh.
Give them to me.
Yeah.
And so that's how it began. I began studying the dreams of family members in therapy, and I collected dozens and dozens and dozens of those dreams, and those became the foundation of the early articles, and then eventually that first book, The Family Unconscious.
Uh-huh. Wow, well, what an interesting career, and it's fascinating how you've stayed true to that original inspiration, that original path that you felt called to, and that's kind of marked your whole career. The interest in dreams,
Interest in dreams. I know that's part of the reason I'm here.
Yeah.
So do it.
Wow.
Do it.
And well, let's get into Let's get into the book a little bit. I was interested in your section. You mentioned history and so on. I was interested in your section on cross-cultural and trans-cultural modes of dreaming. And so maybe you can say a little bit about how people have understood dreams in the past and other parts of the world. And particularly, I noted that you had a section on Africa, and with your African-American background, that might have something to do with that being in the book. And I don't know much about dream work in Africa or the history of dreaming in Africa, so go ahead and rhapsodize a little bit on that.
Well, when I began, it's one of the situations where you know it's true, but you don't have enough data yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew, and plus being as an academic type, I got to get the data. Bruce, you've got to get the data. So I started my studying and starting my research, and the earliest written materials I could find on the study of dreams was in Africa, particularly in ancient Egypt, Kemetic Egypt. And this Kemetic Egypt is the Egypt before the Greeks and the Romans came in, and the Arabs later came in. This is the indigenous folks of Egypt in Nubia, and they had dreams, and they had dream temples. They began the dream temples, you know, that later spread around the Mediterranean basin between 500 AD and 500 BCE. But they began it about 3,500 years before Christ. They
wow.
began these sleep temples.
Yeah.
And they did some phenomenal things. Not only did they study dreams, and they had a word for it, they discovered the unconscious. They discovered the unconscious. There's a book out there by Horning called The Discovery of the Unconscious, and Eric Horning, The Discovery of the Unconscious in Ancient Egypt. He's a Jungian psychologist, but he documents that they understood it. They had names for it, of the unconscious, which is what you have to do, you know, to work with the unconscious. They had two names, the primeval waters of Nun, N-U-N, and the all-black underworld, the Amun-Ntah. And if you look in the Egyptian Book of the Dead with a psychological eye, you can see that they were talking about not only our unconscious, which is primarily an intrapsychic unconscious, but they were talking about the vast unconscious that included not only our own individual unconscious, but the collective unconscious and the unconscious that gives rise to the material world. And they studied it in quite close clinical detail.
Wow.
And they also evolved a lot of very complex techniques, which we haven't quite gotten to yet, for studying of the unconscious, including they discovered not only the use of hypnosis for things that we use, like pain control, which they did, and the study of dreams, which they did, but they also discovered, long before we did, the process of dissociation, of clinical dissociation, such that in many of the temples and the pyramids, they were using this to help a person in rites of resurrection to dissociate from the body, have certain kind of experiences, and then return to the body in the principle of the symbolic process of resurrection. Now, that's where Christians came up with the notion of resurrection. This was an ancient Egyptian idea, 3,000 years before Christ in written form.
Yeah.
But they learned about out-of-body experiences, projection, what we would call dissociation today, and also travel. If you look at the Egyptian hieroglyphs, there's a figure with the body of a bird and the head of a man, the Ba bird. That bird symbolized the consciousness principle, which could be and is projected from the body, not only in certain kinds of dream states, consciously, by the way, in lucid dream states, but also spearheads out-of-body experiences, which have been verified by clinical science. But also, very importantly, this Ba bird was understood to be able to travel the cosmos, something that we say is not possible. But for them, they could. And so the inside of the sarcophagi and so forth, you see all these star maps, which later on turned out to be accurate.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is taboo. This is taboo in our science, because in our Western today arrogance, we don't think anybody knew anything before the mid-19th century. But in point of fact, the ancient Egyptians, because they believed in mummification, they studied the body quite intensely. Mm-hmm. They had close to 250 different anatomical names for parts of the body.
Wow.
They knew about the meninges of the brain and their function. They even had a primitive form of a brain surgery called trepanation, where they would relieve pressure on the brain in certain areas as a clinical technique. So they knew about the unconscious. They knew about medicine. They knew about dissociation.
We do have this tendency to think that a long time ago, people weren't as smart as we are now.
Yeah.
But human beings have just been smart for a long, long time.
Well, you know, one of the things I found fascinating was that, and this took me a while to get over too, is the indoctrination that the pyramids, particularly the three great pyramids of the Giza Plateau, were burial chambers for the pharaohs. Well, nobody's ever discovered an actual body in these pyramids. temples and in the pyramids. The pharaohs tended to be buried in the Valley of the Kings with their families. No, the pyramids were places of initiation, of psychological and spiritual initiation by the priests of that time. And they used the process of hypnosis, dissociation, inducing out-of-body experiences, lucid dreams, all the phenomena that we're aware of, but they had a much more systematized approach to it. And the three great pyramids of the Giza Plateau, the ones that we know most about in Egypt, there are dozens and dozens of these further south in Nubia, but also along the Nile, and satellite photographs have shown this, there are literally a couple of dozen more pyramids under the sand. So wow. Apparently at one time, there was a whole culture there for thousands of years that practiced these rites of deep psychological engagement, projection from the body, and exploring the solar ambience that we have just simply forgotten. Because at some point, which we don't know why, that civilization fell.
Yeah.
That civilization fell, and the migrations from that civilization moved toward West Africa, which is why you find so many uncanny similarities in some of the religious rites on the West Coast and the interior of the West Coast in West Africa. Mali, the Dogon of Mali, Benin, many of the different groups in Africa, particularly West Coast, they had a concept of this and a knowledge of this. They had a knowledge of the unconscious, and they called it by name. They called it the Anyamo complex.
And it sounds like you've been to Africa and maybe to Egypt. Is that right?
I haven't been to Egypt. Been okay. to Africa, haven't been to Egypt. I've been primarily to Egypt. And the other one that's resonates with Egypt is southern India, where I've been.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Many of the same ideas are there. They didn't have a different cultural cloak to them, but many of the same ideas and same energies. The ancient Egyptians talked about that in great detail, and they had contact with the Dravidian peoples of southern India, the ones who created what we think of as yoga today. And this is like 2,000 years before the Indo-Aryan invasions of the north. And so that is some of the stuff I began to sort of explore more in this greatly expanded version of the Dream Life of Families, in uh-huh. which I went into great detail in Dark Light Consciousness.
Yeah.
But as I said before, I put my, you know, I'm coming to the end of my tenure here, so I want to say as much as I can say and back up historically, rationally, and otherwise before my time is up.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you to take a giant leap back from the past to the present, and maybe you can comment on how recent findings in neuroscience have impacted our understanding of the role of dreaming. You know, there's so much new information about the brain and so on, and
yes.
Do you think our notions have changed as a result of that?
I think that they've deepened as a result of that. I think they've ratified some of the things that we've already known and expanded in areas that we haven't known. We know about, obviously, the REM sleep cycle, but we really still don't know what kicks it off. We have theories about that, but we don't really know why. We just know phenomenologically that's what occurs. But the ancient Egyptians did say something about that, the Kemetic Egyptians. They said that you can learn how to enter a dream. You can learn how to consciously enter a dream, and then through that dream, enter directly and consciously into the great Amenta, the great primordial collective unconscious, which is the storehouse of wisdom.
Yeah.
They said you can learn how to do that, and the entry into that is through the dream. That's one of the entries into that, is through the dream, which is rooted in the brain. They had... They mapped out the pathway through the spinal line, and this is where the neuroscience comes in, through the spinal line in the brain, in certain areas of the brain, that they said was where the life force moved. Well, it just so happens that the surface of our brain is covered by material that absorbs light. It's called neuromelanin, not skin melanin, neuromelanin. It's dark and it absorbs light, and it transduces light to higher levels of vibration and form. That's what it does. And it occupies the center of the center column of the brain, spinal line, comes all the way up, and then as it comes up the back of the brain, it flips over and moves out and covers the entire surface of the brain. The surface of our brains are dark gray in color. Well, that's not because they are exposed to sunlight. It's because there is some relationship between that and the absorption of photons, of quanta, of energy from the universe as we move up in evolution. You know, of all the creatures on the planet, the ones that have the most neuromelanin in their brains are the mammals. Of all the mammals, the ones who have the highest concentration of that in their brain and spinal line are the great apes. Of all the great apes, the ones that have the highest, are the chimpanzees. And the only one that has more intensely concentrated that is us, Homo sapiens sapiens. That's a pretty tight correlation.
That's fascinating. I haven't really heard any of this. You know, there was this Harvard psychologist, Hobson, who claimed that dreams were basically meaningless. I know.
I heard his rap, and I don't buy it. And
when
he's deeply engaged in his dreams, he doesn't believe that either. I bet he believes that when he's awake and is reflecting on his dreams, but when he's actually experiencing them, it has a reality to it, a phenomenological reality to it. And in our waking state, we tend to reduce things to this and that. When in point of fact, when we're actually experiencing it, you know, it's the difference between reflecting on love and being in love.
Mm-hmm.
They're two different states, don't you think?
Yeah. So do you think that the findings of neuroscience undercut the therapeutic value of dream work? I gather not.
Yeah. Absolutely not. They enhance it. They enhance it. You know, they amplify it. And these are all tools that we can use to better help relieve suffering in the world, to increase insight in the world. And, you know, our dreaming is part of that. We're not going to, like, you know, all of a sudden come up and say, oh, you know, that's it. How many decades now, since the mid-1800s, have we been saying, well, you know, human beings are nothing but blah, blah, right? We're nothing but, you know, socioeconomic creatures. We're nothing but, you know, workers. Oh, well, the brain is ultimately molecules and organs. Oh, well, the brain is ultimately blah, 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 on and on and on. This sort of thinking is part of the dilemma of the world that we're in now, where we've reduced our vision of what we are, despite our intuition, to the point that we think of ourselves as nameless, faceless, pointless, interacting, entropy, heat death, kind of replaceable parts.
Oh no!
You know, right? This is the kind of propaganda that leads to a world in which, you know, some person who's no doubt feels like a total failure can, you know, go out and buy himself a gun, walk into a place, and just start mowing down people.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you know, that happened just yesterday.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. 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 So our dreams. Our dreams are critical. The study of our dreams and the recognition of our dreams is part of what led us out of the caves, down from the trees, to walk across the savannas, and eventually walk across the earth. And eventually, I believe this in my deepest self, one day our progeny, ages from now, will still be on different planets studying their dreams. They'll look at it differently. They'll have a different theory, but that's what they're going to be doing, because we've been doing that since we were sitting around the caves and watching the fire go out under the night sky.
Well, I love your projection into the future, and so does Elon Musk, who is designing the rocket ship to do it.
Yes, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
We're going to do it. That is our destiny.
Yeah.
I believe it.
Okay. Let's get back to families, focus on the families. How are dreams and family life related?
Well, from my point of view, I mean, we all, I should say, I wouldn't say all, I'd say, well, certainly all human beings dream. In fact, we know that we have to dream, and if we're stopped from dreaming, we get kind of weird, we get kind of funky. Yep. The studies should show that. So we need to dream as part of our mammalian inheritance. All the other primates dream, whales and dolphins dream. I mean, we all dream. We have to dream. Okay. The other is that either a significant amount or even if it's just a fragment of our identity has to do with our familial, our family sense. That doesn't mean that you're close or distantly related, but we all have some intuition of family. Even those of us who might not have one will look for it with other people. Okay?
Yeah.
So it's part of our identity, deep, deep identity. And it's part of our unconscious. So the family's unconscious in some permutation and our dream states, most of which, again, are both unconscious, fuse together in our day-to-day experience. A good 20-ish to 25% of daily, or rather I should say nightly dreams, in certain permutation involve family members. That's what this research shows.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it's dreaming specifically and only about that person, but in some permutation, a relative, cousin, parent, whatever, you know, 20-ish percent of the time will appear in a dream because we're as part of our consciousness.
Yeah.
And that's how they weave together. So it's not only a psychological phenomenon, but it's a biogenetic phenomenon.
Yeah.
And part of what I tried to do in the dream life of families is sort of like expand that and bringing in some of the notions, particularly some of the notions in West Africa about the extended family. You know, we here in the States, we tend to think of our family or as family as consisting of, you know, our local family, you know, parents, sibs, and maybe a few cousins and so on. In West Africa, the family matrix is expanded. It includes not only the folks living, as we just described, or even people living in a compound, but it also includes the people that you are related to who are at this particular time with you on the earth. Another mm-hmm. level of that is those people who have just recently departed.
Mm-hmm.
They are still part of the family, which is why there's so many what's called visitation dreams of people who've just departed appearing to people.
Yeah.
This is all over the earth.
Yeah.
And then there's another level beyond that of those who have been in it's called a Sasa, who've been departed for some period of time, for perhaps a couple of generations. But they still will sometimes appear in dreams. I've had ancestral dreams of great-great-grandparents appearing to me in dreams and talking to me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and just sort of like passing on something to me.
Yeah. Which is... Do you have one like that you'd be comfortable sharing?
Yes, and I put this out there not only in the dream life of families, but I've written in terms of poetry about this. But one of the images that was most striking, one of my visceral experiences, well, actually there were two. One was in my father just passed, and he died suddenly, and I had a dream about him, and I knew he was going to appear in the next couple of days. Just as a regular situation. But when he did appear to me in that dream, I was aware that he had died, and I went up to him, and I started talking to him, and I said, Dad, you died. And he was very confused. He died suddenly of a heart attack. So he was kind of in a confused state. No, Dad, da-da-da-da-da. And I helped him sort of move toward light, and that was my work with him.
Mm-hmm.
It was, it was a primal experience for me. I have absolutely no doubts about it.
Yeah,
and another one that's more distant is, and this has occurred 3 or 4 times in my life, where I've had a dream of a distant relative, and that has not been a grandparent, and not even a great grandparent, but somebody further back than that, who kind of came to me and gave me something that was in past to somebody else, pass it to somebody else and then eventually hand it to me. And it was, it's usually a scroll of some sort. And on it, it's all kinds of, like, written stuff that I can't really decipher, but I know it somehow is important.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, so I'm sticking with it. You know, I, at this particular point, as I said, I'm all in, and so right. I know what the objections of psychoanalysis would be, but it doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah.
Let
me share one of my dreams with you, which was I mentioned my stepfather, and after he died, sometime after he died, not immediately after or anything, I dreamt that I was in a play, and the phone rang as part of being in the play. And you know, if you're in a play, they'll ring a phone, but the phone's not really connected to anything. And so it was that kind of thing. I picked up this phone that was not really connected to a phone line or anything in the play, but I hear my dad's voice, and he says to me, "The circle of your existence is about to close." That is a message that has stayed with me. And of course, if I took that very literally, and this was something I wanted to explore with you, a lot of times people will take dream messages too literally. And if I had taken it super literally, I would have figured, I'm about to die, or I've got a dread disease, and this is what this dream is telling me. So it, while it still has a bit of a mysterious element, and I don't remember the exact timing of this, but I had been on sort of a quest to find my biological father. And sometime after this dream, I believe that finally happened. And that's a whole magical story of synchronicities that we don't have time to go into here.
But I just wanted to feel it.
Yeah.
You know, living in a larger realm, you make connections that in our more limited situation are more difficult to do. And that's the advantage of being immersed in a vaster unconscious, or at least unconscious to us.
What do you think about, you know, as I mentioned, I taught a class on dreams for a long time, and frequently students would kind of freak out because they would have a dream of a relative who was going to die or had died or something like that in the dream, and they struggled with, is this going to happen now? Is this a warning, or does this represent some kind of hostile feelings that I have about this relative? How do you walk that fine line?
Well, you know, I try in that situation to stay open to what the person's obvious experience is, and sometimes the person who they're dreaming about does die later, but oftentimes, in fact, most of the time, they do not. And so, you know, we have a good, solid, either psychodynamic or family systems approach interpretation to dreams, but sometimes dreams have a numinous quality to them. They have a numinous quality to them. And those are the dreams that we feel, at least I certainly feel differently about, and I listen to differently. And it's hard to sort of communicate that numinous feeling, but it is not, you don't shake it when you wake up.
That's a good way to put it. I think it relates to what Jung called big dreams. That's always been a meaningful distinction to me since I heard about it. And there are some, just a few. I've only had a few big dreams, but
I've had a number of I call them teaching dreams to me, and they are. I feel very humbled by them, and they're very informative. And I usually, this is maybe unique to me, I don't know, but of all the books that I've authored, they've all begun as a dream.
Ah, fascinating.
They've all begun as a dream, and then my work in the waking state is to use my academic and mildly obsessive a detail-oriented thing to sort of put it together. But the initial vision has almost always come from a dream.
Well, it sounds like you are, you have an attitude in which you're a willing student of the dream. And that's probably why your dreams are teaching dreams. I mean, they can't be teaching unless there's a receiver there, and you're clearly oriented towards being the receiver.
Oh, absolutely, and you do it with great with gratefulness and humility, and periodically, I've been fortunate enough to enter into or be engulfed in what's called a clear light experience, and that's where everything is like dissolves, and there's just light.
Wow.
And that's only occurred, a couple of dozen times in my whole life, but it's enough to let me know that this is a what we're dwelling in is a limited subset of the real.
Uh-huh. Hey, a couple of dozen times, that sounds like a lot to me. That's a real gift. I don't know if this is a variant of what you're talking about or not, but every now and then I have what I call a magical mystery tour dream where, and I guess it's really numinous, where when I wake up, it's like I've been through some a fantastic experience that was probably very colorful and lots of stuff happening and people and interaction and so on. But I'm so regretful to have woken from it. And it's so, there's no way that words can render it. It
yes.
doesn't make sense to even try to tell somebody else about it. But it was just kind of a breathtaking experience.
Awe.
Yeah, awe.
Awe. Yeah, awe. And it expands mind, it expands consciousness. Oh, yeah. No, I've been fortunate enough to stumble into that a number of times, and I'm always grateful afterwards, and I say so out loud. I just give thanks. I just say, thank you.
Yes, exactly. Gratitude is is the most appropriate thing that you can do in relation to that experience.
Right, and to recognize that, like Benjamin Franklin said, way, way back, Benjamin Franklin said, we're all on this vast journey meant to last for thousands of years. He did.
Franklin. I didn't know that. Yeah,
he did. And that in a letter to someone who had lost a parent or a dear person, and he was trying to sort of console them, and he was saying, essentially, you're on a journey meant to last for thousands of years, and you can have many different experiences in and out of apparent situations that you can recognize and others that you don't. And that's always intuitively resonated with me in a way that's hard for me to communicate in other than poetry. I some things you can say, quote, in psychology language, unquote, but sometimes I can't. And the only language I have is poetry. And so I trust it and put it out there and see where it goes. Gamble and throw the dice and see what goes.
Well, one of the exercises that I used to do in my class, and I can't say I invented this. I think I probably heard it from somebody in ASD. As a matter of fact, you mentioned Henry Reed in your book, and I may have gotten it from him. But I would have people use their dream as a springboard for poetry, and then very quickly, and then to share around the group what they had written, and then for the group to kind of, one of the interesting things is that the poems that people would write to another person's dream, the meaning would be kind of emerge collectively. Themes, the main theme would be recognized by other people. And one of the things I say to them is, hey, if I had asked you to analyze this dream, it would have been a very different experience than using the dream as a springboard for a poem. That really engaged you at an intuitive level, and that's why we hear as much agreement here. And so, I've done that, and also for haiku, which is also a really fun exercise to work with dream my own it or is. Somebody else's and turn it into a haiku.
Well, I hear you. I hear you. I mean, I do this periodically, and you know, sometimes I do it intentionally. Sometimes I just sort of find myself in it, slip in it. Wow. But at this particular point, I trusted. I just trusted enough to know the limit, my limitations, that on both borders and ends of my life, there's a great ignorance. And so yeah. I just sort of said, okay, and you know, beware. You know, sort of a sublime ignorance, just sort of like, okay. Uh-huh. This is it. I'm going to, if I'm fortunate, continue to be fortunate. I'll do this until, you know, the end of the days, and you know, then we'll see what that was about.
Well, if you go before I do, which is, I don't know how likely that is, but let's try to meet on that other plane. And
well, we probably will, and we probably already have.
That could be. That could be. It feels like there's a lot of points of connection here. So, well, I was going to ask you about the subtitle of the book, which was about the psycho-spiritual connection, but I think you've been talking about that a lot already.
Well, I hope so. And that wasn't my subtitle. That was the publisher's subtitle, and I thought I like it. I said, that works. And
yeah.
So I went with that.
Yeah. So I think that's been kind of a lot of the subtext of what we've been talking about. You're a family therapist. You started asking people in couples and family therapy about their dreams. Are they, in fact, useful in that context, I say?
Oh, very, you know, very useful, but, yeah. Because they bypass the ego and you go directly into primary process.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
Carl Whitaker is the one that taught me that the primary process is where the life force dwells.
Uh-huh.
And so to go into that and to get people to see you enough and trust you enough to allow that to happen, yeah. And in order to do that, at least I've found, I've had to share my primary process with people at times. And that's been okay. It's been okay. It hasn't been as bad a thing is the psychoanalytic folks would have you believe.
Well, when you say share your primary process, are you talking about in the form of a dream or free association on the couch or what?
Both free association and in dream. And I've let people know that, and I've always couched it in terms of, well, this is me, and it may be true, may not be true for you, but this is what's coming up in my mind.
Sure.
That's happened
yeah.
at crucial points at therapy at different times. And a number of times it's been extremely revealing, and I had no idea where it was coming from. But I couched it in terms of, this is me, not you.
Uh-huh.
And I offered it to see if it was in any way useful for the person I've been trying to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me of doing, again, in the context of working with students in small dream groups of six or eight students, typically. And, you know, I try to teach them to be non-judgmental and so on. But I will be hearing some students saying, you know, what their associate, if this were my dream, here's what it would be about. And I'm sort of inside groaning and going, oh man, this is really so far off the beaten path, you know, this is just crazy talk. And the dreamer will light up and say, yeah, that's it. So much for this, you know, educated psychologist here.
Well, you know, people pick up on different resonances, you know, that's so much of many of our relationships in the world, not only with family members but other folks, are determined by resonance. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
A resonance and vibration.
Yeah, there's something
literally
going on,
so.
I gotta say,
and there's an identity deeper than our egos. We know that. We just oftentimes don't know what to do with it. It's like who was it? The great Jesuit paleontologist and priest Teilhard de Chardin. He said that we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
Uh-huh.
I was like that.
Yeah.
You know, we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And that's always rang really deeply true to me.
It's said with such economy. That's great. Just a short line like that.
Yeah.
Now, you've been conducting something, I gather, over the years that called the Family Dream Research Project. What can you tell us about
that? Yes, well, that was that original project that I began at Elmcrest Psychiatric Institute way back in, must have been 76, 77, way back then, where I started asking people family members to submit their dreams to me, without editing. And I just made a collection of them. And over the years, I gathered hundreds and hundreds of these, and I grouped them into different categories of affinity in terms of a correspondence of images, ideas, and affect or emotion within the dreams between people who they identify. And there's a protocol that they reported on and so forth. And then I made a call out into different magazines and other things that people would send me that, all confidential. Yeah. I'd change the names and stuff and asked for them to give me permission to present them if it seemed appropriate. So I've collected hundreds of these and put them in. I was able to put them into, several categories, and that became the basis for the Dream Life of Families, and earlier the Families in the Interpretation of Dreams. Again, with the Dream Life of Families, I allowed myself to go much further in terms of some of the notions that were at an intuitive level back then, or ones that I was perhaps overly concerned about what the academic reaction would be. But I was at a different point in my career,
sure.
And at this point, it's all there, plus these added things that we've been talking about this afternoon. So, I'm doing what I can do on this end, and, you put it out there and see where it goes, and you trust that, somehow the universe is going to resonate back with you.
Well, I have to respect that part of you that wanted to to sort of hit all your marks on in terms of your traditional psychology career, because I noticed in your book that you're board certified with what in the APA is called the ABEP. What does that stand for anyway?
American Board of Professional Psychology. Once you get your doctorate, and then you get licensed, hopefully in the state that you're working in. But then if you either want to torture yourself, or you're deeply obsessive, or you just continually need some sort of challenge, you go and you study for a few years in some specialty area within psychology. Mine was clinical psychology. And you sit before a board, you take some written exams and so forth beyond licensure, and it's sort of like it's like being board certified. And
yeah.
That means that this is my specialty area, beyond licensure and so forth.
Yeah,
and,
well, I'm impressed.
I did that part of it. I did that partly because to balance out, I knew that many of the areas that I felt called upon to explore would strike a number of people is kind of out there. I knew that.
Uh-huh.
And so I needed to balance that with a real solid, deep-rooted clinical and academic credentials. So that's why I did it.
I totally understand that. That's a great strategy. And I have to say I'm impressed that you did that. That's like getting your black belt in California, in psychology.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to add.
Well, other than this has been a great and expansive interview, a couple of things that I tackled, approached in the Dream Life of Families that were not in the original, is I began to explore some of the ideas of localization of consciousness and consciousness in a more transpersonal mode. And from a family systems perspective, with a few different assumptions, how the process of reincarnation would appear logical from a certain perspective. And I base that partly on intuition, but also there's a huge, huge body of empirical research out there on phenomena of children who remember past lives and related phenomena that's been done by universities, medical schools and universities. And, you know, our mainstream psychology just does not know what to do with it yet.
Yeah.
But it's solid stuff.
Huh. And it's, I've not really gone deeply into that area, and I'm aware that there's something out there, so it's good to be reminded of that.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is, and it's just that we don't know what to do with it yet. So I brought that in, and a few other areas, and as I said, I expanded the historical work, and just tried to bring it more up to date and make it more fulfilling, and point out with appropriate humility that we are not, our age is not the only age that's ever known anything about how the mind works.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good wrap-up there. So, Dr. Edward Bruce Bynum, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, I really enjoyed this, truly, truly enjoyed this, and we'll have to make a point of meeting in the flesh.
Wow, this felt like old home week. Dr. Edward Bruce Bynum encouraged me to call him Bruce in our chat just before the interview, so I will refer to him here as Bruce. And even though we've never met in person, we have so much in common in our histories that I got very excited, as I'm sure you could tell. Also, as I'm sure you could tell from the interview, that the subtitle of his book, The Psycho-Spiritual Connection, has emerged as a very large and important part of his 2017 update to the book. Just as that topic pervaded our discussion in so many ways, it's clear that this is a big part of where his heart is these days. I was particularly fascinated by his discussion of the importance of dream work in Egypt and other parts of Africa, some of it going back 3,000 years or more. Clearly, he's a scholar and has put what he referred to as his obsessive, detail-oriented part of his personality into a lot of historical research on the use of dreams in our collective past. We had a bit of a chat after the interview, continuing to compare notes about our both having been connected to the University of New Hampshire, but at different times, and other synchronistic seeming parallels in our lives. Also, as a kind of leitmotif in our conversation, he kept repeating with such passion how lucky we both have been to study the mind. David, we're so lucky. We got to study the mind. Unfortunately, Bruce lives on the East Coast and I live in Northern California. I say unfortunately because I think we could be great friends and wish that he lived somewhere a lot closer. I definitely do look forward to any opportunity that we might have to meet in person. In the meantime, I strongly recommend his book to all you dreamers and fans of dreaming out there. As you know, dream work has been a significant thread in my own journey, and that's been reflected in the many interviews I've conducted touching on that topic over the past 13 years. If you decide to purchase The Dream Life of Families, The Psycho-Spiritual Connection by Edward Bruce Bynum, Ph.D., I hope you'll use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com to do that.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Cindy Gozanski from Portland, Maine. I am a master's-level psychotherapist, and I have chosen to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially because of the immense benefit that I get from your podcast. I am in private practice and an adjunct instructor for our graduate counseling program at University of Southern Maine, and find that your Shrink Wrap Radio guests and information is so helpful to me in both of these fields. Often, after I hear one of your guests, I purchase the book or go to their website and I'm able to really incorporate more of the amazing information, techniques, tips, and other things that are so useful that you provide. Again, I am so grateful for the wonderful features that Shrink Wrap Radio provides to all of the listeners, and especially the professional listeners like myself in the area. And I have shared Shrink Wrap Radio and will continue to do so with many of my students and colleagues. Once again, thank you so much, Dr. Dave, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Cindy Gozanski, up in the great state of Maine, for encouraging others to follow your very much appreciated example. If you're not already a financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Cindy by going to our website and click on the big support button in the right-hand sidebar. You'll feel so glad that you did, and so will I. I'm not sure if you know that beneath that big support button on the right-hand sidebar at Shrink Wrap Radio is a list of ads for books by some of our authors. They link to the author's book on Amazon.com. These authors pay $25 a month in hope that you will find them there and purchase their book. I really encourage you to scroll down and take a look at the books that are there. I'm offering a free 3 months of advertising to Matthew Dolitz, who has just published his book, The Psychotherapist's Essential Guide to the Brain. This really is an essential book for anyone who wishes a quick reference to all the new information about the brain. For example, how about the section on epigenetics, condensed to 4 pages with lavish illustrations? Or how about the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex or the ventromedial prefrontal cortex? Do you know where they are? I can barely say them. There's a beautiful illustration showing you exactly where they are in the brain. How about the glial cells? Do you know their function? What about the default mode of the brain? All this and more is written about succinctly, clearly, and beautifully illustrated in only 146 pages, making this a must-have reference book to keep near at hand. In fact, it will enhance your listening to Shrink Wrap Radio because many of my guests refer to these topics and areas of the brain, and at times they might be hard to visualize. By the way, if the name Matthew Dolitz sounds familiar, it's because we have a strategic partnership to support each other's endeavors as much as we can. He publishes the Neuropsychotherapist online magazine, as well as The Age of Robots, and I'm involved in both. So do take a look in the right-hand sidebar of the Shrink Wrap Radio website, where you'll see a picture of the book cover, which links to Amazon.com. The price is very reasonable, considering what a valuable reference resource this will be for you, now and into the future.
Hello, this is Dr. Edward Bruce Bynum, clinical psychologist and author of The Dream Life of Families, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you once again to Dr. Bruce Bynum, who of course was today's guest. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. This one is from Mahiar in Tehran, longtime listener and super fan, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I only got back to my computer after 2 days just to find out about the recent attack in Las Vegas. It's such a brutal, violent happening that really makes me shiver at the thought of it. The death toll is just unbelievable, and I'm sure the situation must be really gloomy and stressful there in the U.S. I write this wishing to be a way to express my sadness and condolence. In the face of such shocks and atrocities, my trust in your work and that of the people, such as yourself, becomes much more strengthened. It is really a comfort to know that there are people there who might be able to help the remaining victims to heal their wounds and the terror they had to suffer. Still, the pain of the event is such a deep one, about which I cannot easily hope to write. I send you my deepest regards, Mahiar." I can't tell you how ashamed of our country I feel receiving a letter such as this from Iran. Certainly, I appreciate Mahiar's thoughtfulness and sensitivity, but this is not the America that in the past I thought to hold up to the world as a shining example of democracy. I'd like to believe we are better than this. Guns are just shockingly too available in this country. According to a 2013 study, quote, there are by various estimates anywhere from 270 million to 310 million guns in the United States, close to one firearm for every man, woman, and child. But in point of fact, only a minority of Americans own guns, period, close quote. There have been more deaths by gunshot in this country than all the soldiers killed in all our wars since the beginning of the country. In this massacre of just days ago, 59 killed and more than 500 wounded. I hope my U.S. listeners will do all they can to lobby for tighter gun control laws and processes. This madness must stop. So with that, once again, we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Edward Bruce Bynum, for sharing his passion about the dream life of families, as well as his expanded experience of the universe. My next guest will be Dr. Arlene Drake, and we'll be discussing her book, Carefrontation, which outlines her powerful approach to repairing the damage of childhood abuse and its lasting effects. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.